Funds for Bookworm are provided in part by Lannan Foundation.
You are a human animal. You are a very special breed. For you are the only animal who can think, who can reason, who can read.
From KCRW Santa Monica, I'm Michael Silverblatt, and this is Bookworm. Today, I'm happy to have Jennifer Egan, the author, most recently, of The Keep, a novel published by Knopf. We're particularly thrilled to have Jennifer here because we had her on very early in Bookworm's history when I fell in love with a short story of hers called Why China that was in her collection of stories, Emerald City. She's the author as well of a novel, Look at Me, and also another novel, The Invisible Circus. I'm very curious here because the reader, in a sense, has to go a little crazy while reading this book. I was interested in how in control you are of what you might call the sub-effects, those things that a reader comes to suspect. It's a kind of gothic novel, or at least someone is writing a gothic novel in the course of it. And a lot of the book depends upon keeping the reader very uncertain as to the status of the reality of what they're reading. It seemed hard to control that effect, and I wonder how you do it.
Well, I was never sure whether I was getting it right. I mean, in the end, I always have to rely on some trusted readers to tell me. The way that I write is very blind. I write by hand, and I don't really know what's going to happen next. So I was pretty steeped in Gothic literature by the time I started writing The Keep, and I was certainly excited about some of the conventions of the genre. The one that interested me the most was the fact that the central question of a Gothic novel is almost always, is it real or is it not real? And so keeping the reader on that edge is critically important. Like if you think of something like The Turn of the Screw, we need to really not know whether this governess is projecting her own tumultuous inner state onto the landscape when she sees these apparitions or whether she's actually seeing ghosts. It's much more fun if the reader doesn't know. I mean, that's really what opens up into all the big questions. So I wondered a lot as I was working on The Keep whether I was going to be getting that balance right because I you know, a guy goes to a castle, strange things start to happen, as they always do. He begins to feel very paranoid, and it's very important that the reader not know whether he is rightly feeling besieged by forces around him or whether he is imagining it. And so I didn't know, and I was actually surprised that the balance seemed to be mostly right in as I had moved through it, just following my instincts. But of course, there's always tons of nipping and tucking and adjusting that needs to happen. But actually less about keeping that balance than about certain other things in the novel that needed more work.
Well, one of the prisoners in the author's writing class says that he kind of resents not knowing what's going to happen next and having the author present in their workshop, they practically want to throttle him to find out the next secret. And it does seem to be the case with this kind of writing. I remember when I was marooned in a Gothic fiction class, that sense, you know, those books are interminable.
Oh, yeah.
And they really get quite annoying.
They're often a mess. It's true.
Mrs. Radcliffe, every 70 pages or so, a figure emerges through the mists and then disappears into the mists. And that's all that happens for the next 70 pages. And you have to wait for the next mist to part. And yet at the same time, the anxiety level remains very high because there's that creepy instability that genre generates, partially, I guess, because the writers themselves didn't know what they were writing. It was brand new. It was coming after Henry Fielding and all those kinds of things. And so no one knew how to write a novel like this. And you get the in Monk Lewis and all of those books, you get this teetering feeling. And that is true of this book, too. Not the boredom, but the sense of something, you know, kind of shimmering and about to break, because the tension doesn't know exactly how to sustain itself. It has to break at exactly the right moment. And it's almost as if the book is about keeping the reader over-engaged but at a distance.
That's interesting. No, I mean, that. I think that is that teetering feeling that, as you say, manages to hold the reader through a lot of tedium in some of these older Gothic novels. Without the tedium, was exactly what interested me about writing a book like this. I mean, there's such a high wire quality to it. And in a way, you know, as you suggest, the early Gothic novels come so early in the history of the novel that there is a feeling of a kind of connection between this genre and the very early makings of the novel as it tried to figure out what it was. And maybe that's why there's such a convention of texts inside texts and a lot of attention paid to the question of who is speaking and why. There's always a frame story, almost always, and in certainly the older Gothic stuff, and often a frame inside a frame that we kind of tend to forget as we look back on it, like The Turn of the Screw. We tend to just remember the story about the governess. But in fact, there's a rather complicated frame around that in which people are telling a story. A manuscript needs to be found. It has to be sent for. It finally comes back. And in fact, the whole story is being told later by someone who was present at that first telling. So all of that really interested me a lot. And, you know, in a certain sense, this book has been called metafiction, which it definitely is. I mean, it certainly is a book about itself being written, but I don't really love the term metafiction because it's sort of yawny. I mean, it tends to make me think of a kind of academic exercise that doesn't really necessarily excite the reader. But what I loved was that the excitement of that Gothic tension and all of the funny feelings that go along with that, a kind of cheesy nostalgia, a sense of separation from reality, a real artificiality, and yet a kind of compulsion at the heart of all of it.
I'm interested in that term, a real artificiality. What does that mean to you? Because it seems like a crucial one for you.
Well, I think I've just said it for the first time. So real artificiality to me gets at the question of how to make something removed from reality and yet still have a pulse. I mean, how to make it real and unreal at the same time. That was basically the question I was asking myself. And it gets to that question at the heart of Gothic fiction, which is it real or is it not real? It's never interesting to have that question answered. So I thought about that a lot as I was working on this. You know, how will these questions be resolved for the reader? And my goal was definitely not to answer the question, is it real or is it not? And ideally to make the question somewhat irrelevant, because I think what drew me to this form was in part an interest in certain questions about reality raised by telecommunications. And a lot of this book, or one of the fun things for me, had to do with letting modern connectedness collide with Gothic remoteness. And to ask questions about whether, you know, whether some of the same questions about whether experience is real or not can be asked of this new disembodied communication, newish, I should say, newly omnipresent disembodied communication that we, many of us, engage in nowadays.
One of the things that really struck me was, oddly, the story that we talked about last time you were here, Why China, has something of the same preoccupations in that it deals with the possibility that two men are in a retaliatory plot with one another. One has ripped the other off. They meet again by accident. One isn't recognized. And there may be a retaliation going on against the con man. That story, too, ends in a cave.
That's very interesting.
Isn't that odd?
I had never thought of that.
I knew it was, you know, unintentional, and yet I do think that one of the things about the Gothic is that it involves primal imagery, that images that are somehow in the author's fear district resurrect, and therefore writers who verge on the Gothic all the time, like Charles Dickens, have all of that recurrent imagery from book to book because it can't be played out. The writing of a novel doesn't settle or work out the image to its finality. And so I wondered how you felt about the book as a continuation rather than a departure.
I feel it's very much a continuation. I think people perceive it at times as a departure because the world of it is so different. But I think what you point out is something that I've always known about myself, which is that I'm totally fascinated by doppelgangers. And in a way, that's really what Why China is, in a certain sense. These two men who have interacted in the way that one has conned the other meet again in this faraway place, and in a certain sense, or at least the protagonist ends up confronting certain things about himself in his confrontation with this other man. It's sort of a classic doppelganger story in a way, and my first novel, The Invisible Circus, is in a way even more of a doppelganger story. You know, it's a two sisters who look alike. One is alive. One is dead. The live one tries to understand what happened to the dead one. I mean, when I describe it like that, it sounds totally gothic. It's Dark Shadows. It's actually not, I would not describe that as a gothic novel at all.
I'm speaking with Jennifer Egan on the occasion of her new novel, The Key, published by Knopf. And I'm Michael Silverblatt. You're listening to Bookworm from the studios of KCRW. We'll continue after this short break. I'm Michael Silverblatt. This is Bookworm, and I'm talking with Jennifer Egan about her novel, The Keep. Now, I remember that when Kubrick was making The Shining, one saw publicity stills of every type of spiders crawling out of a skull, a preview in which an elevator stopped at a floor and emptied a tidal pool of blood. By the time the movie appeared, not much in the way of sensational effect was left. And one of the things about The Keep that interested me is that the effects are kept basically to a minimum. It's not a book that's full of corpses or blood. Many of the Gothics are animated while waiting for the next startle. This is more about, well, phases. A list appears toward the end of the book of the character going through phases of madness and disorientation and disintegration. And it seemed that the real structure of the book was to follow a set of possibilities that the reader will have to encounter as well in the reading that will leave the narrator, if he is indeed the narrator, at a state where he doesn't know who he meets when he opens a door.
Well, I think it's true that there is not much out-and-out horror in this book. And I think that one reason I shied away from that is that to me, that falls to the side of answering the question, is it real or is it not, too fully. You know, for example, if you think of the Stephen King book, Salem's Lot, to me, which I really love, the most exciting part of that book for me comes before we really realize we're dealing with vampires and the blood starts flowing. I mean, it's scary in a different way once there's an evil, there are evil creatures out there and they're doing evil things. But to me, the more delicious tension comes in not exactly knowing what we're dealing with. And I think I really wanted to stick with that in here because I'm not actually interested in the genre of horror. I'm not drawn to it as a reader. It seems it's somehow a little bit too obvious to me, or it just doesn't hold that balance that we talked about as well as more eerie fiction, as you were saying. I did like very much the idea that I don't really know how I'm going to resolve stories as I begin them. And I kept having a sense with this one as I was heading into the first draft that there would be a way in which these different narratives would somehow collapse, that somehow three dimensions would become two dimensions. And I didn't really know what that meant. I mean, I just sort of had that in my mind. But I think in a way that really does end up happening in a certain sense that, you know, we have the castle story and then we have the story around that. And then there's an additional layer that becomes clear at the end. And I think that there was a way in which I wanted it all finally to collapse into its own made-upness, because it really is a book about storytelling and about the imagination, and that on some level it made sense to do the honest thing and let the reader confront the fact that this is all made up. I made it up. So that, you know, trying to answer the question of who's telling the story, choosing among the three possible storytellers within the novel, is, you know, ignoring the fourth storyteller or the fifth or sixth or whatever, namely me. And this is made up, and this kind of imaginative storytelling, you know, is about creating these worlds in which we lose our bearings.
So what's fascinating here, this book is mostly mechanics. It's about changes of point of view. It's about the possibility between stories rather than anything actually being revealed. And so it becomes a book like a castle that is a structure.
It's interesting. I really do. I love that phrase that you seized on, real artificiality, because, again, I felt like the real challenge for me working on this was, but how to make it matter? How can the people matter in this world that is essentially artificial and that I knew would ultimately collapse? How can they be three-dimensional and really strong and yet not exist? And how can I write them that way and yet in a certain sense not be trying to persuade the reader finally, yes, these people exist, they're walking around on the earth? It was an interesting balance to try to strike. And along with that went another challenge that I wondered about, which was, because the book is funny. I mean, in a way, I think that the humor is more overt than the scariness. And I kept wondering, you know, can a book be funny and also eerie? It seemed, I wasn't quite sure if those two things could coexist. I think in the world of horror movies, that is a much more common conjunction. But I couldn't really think of other novels I'd read that were genuinely eerie and also funny, and even have a sort of slapstick quality as this book does. So one of the amusing things for me technically was just to try to make some of these seemingly disparate states coexist. It was really, that was what made it interesting technically.
Well, I had an idea that I think is kind of interesting. You're very good in the earlier books about questions generated by love. Not just does he love me, but is he dangerous to me? Am I dangerous to him? Is what I think happening, what I think is happening, is it actually happening? Can I make this happen? What would happen if I, you know, in Look at Me, the characters need to seduce one another repeatedly, and yet there's something strategic and calculated about it. And I realized that in this book, The Keep, by my guest Jennifer Egan, the paranoia in the book is very much like the paranoia of uncertainty of love.
That's another really interesting point that I hadn't thought of. I think that's true. I mean, I'm interested in the way in which one's state of mind can turn from total confidence or connection or a sense of being able to see clearly. I'm interested in the way in which that can fold in on itself and become exactly its opposite. And in a way, I think that the probably the case of that we all know best is in romantic love. You know, the feeling that one is loved, that one can trust, that that one is known and knows completely. I think there's probably not a person around who doesn't know the feeling of having all of that turned on its head and finding that all of that was the trust, the sense of mutual knowledge, all of that was wrong, and that love has in some way been betrayed or never really was what we thought. I'm very interested in those moments when everything becomes nothing. And, you know, Danny, the protagonist of The Keep, has a way of describing this. Now, there isn't actually – well, there is some romantic love in this book, probably less than my previous ones. But, you know, he's in love with a woman in New York with whom he's trying to communicate. And he feels in moments that she loves him very much, and he definitely loves her very much. And the final conversation they have is one in which they're talking in a cell phone, and he becomes convinced that she is not really whom she says she is. And he questions her very forcefully, trying to make her identify herself so that he can be sure that it really is the woman he loves. And then his behavior toward her is so strange that she becomes convinced that he is not Danny. And so they end up alienated strangers and hang up for the last time, feeling that they haven't actually spoken.
Well, in addition, one of the narrators of the book is in jail. And he tells us that sex in jail, since it doesn't exist, it can be replaced by the touch of a hand, and that these things become hard to attain, too, as hard to attain as an actual encounter. And so we watch while between him and his workshop teacher, the exchange of these stories is like love letters, and he reads her marginal comments as not critical responses, but responses to him. And so what we're kind of watching is the way in which all of this plotting and machinery is about reading messages and interpreting messages that may or may not be being sent.
Yeah, I think that's true. And, you know, he tells this story as a way of communicating with his teacher. But in a way, the story's status as part of a love exchange goes even deeper, because his teacher awakens his imagination in some way. She invites him to write, and he at first ridicules this, but finds that somehow she has touched him. And so she provides him with a kind of escape from his surroundings. He finds that the whole world feels different once he is in this storytelling mode. And then ultimately, he essentially gives the same thing back to her at the end of the book. So I think that in a certain way, it's all certainly the telling of this story in some way is a romantic exchange of messages between two individuals.
Now, I want to ask you something that's, you know, may not be easy to answer. I was once talking to Diane Johnson and Alice Adams. They were close friends. They had both decided about the other. Diane had thought that Alice knew about relationships. Alice says, "I can write about them because they terrify me." Diane, on the other hand, who had a long-standing marriage, wasn't terrified by relationships. She could only write about what scared her on another kind of political, social, under the surface kind of creepiness. Now, almost all your characters are pretty severe neurotics. I mean, in all of the books, no one escapes this. And I wondered where your own layer of confidence and strength comes from, and what of what you write about do you in fact fear?
Wow, that is a hard and good question. I feel like I'll figure out the real answer to that about 2 hours after I leave the studio.
But make a stab, please.
Well, it's funny. I mean, it may be a sign of how it may tell you more than anything when I say that I don't really see my characters as neurotic. I'm not really sure even what that means. I mean, I feel like that's really the only reality that I know. I do have a someone I'm very close to who is mentally ill, and I think that that relationship has informed my work in all kinds of ways, because I think what it's made me realize is that what we think of as craziness is just, you know, part of a continuum on which all of us rest, probably at different points at different times. You know, psychosis is means that you hear voices. Well, that's what I do for a living. You know, I basically feel like I am transcribing sometimes, and I love that feeling. Now, that in a way is a difference between me and some other writers who are more planners and organizers. I tend to write very much from the gut, and then I figure out what I'm doing. So I think that the way in which what we think of as madness in fact touches all experience at different times has always been greatly interesting to me. In terms of what I fear, I feel like in a way I'm someone who's afraid of everything. I don't write about my life at all, but it's mostly because I love the sense of discovery that comes from imagining myself elsewhere. I think that I don't know if this is an answer to your question, but my impulse is to mention the fact that Charlotte the Elder in Look at Me, who is really someone who is, she is very tough, she's very strong, she is sexually very aggressive, she is in some ways more like we think of a man being. She says what's on her mind, she is not deferential at all. She is probably my diametric opposite. And I found her absolutely thrilling to write as. I loved going into the mind of someone like that and into the life of someone like that. And, you know, so maybe there's a fear of being out in the world in a certain way and taking certain chances that I can only take by inhabiting these strong characters and letting them do the hard work. so I don't know if that really answers your question. I fear a lot of things, and I think that writing is a really great job for someone who fears a lot of things, because you can do anything with your mind.
I've been speaking with Jennifer Egan about her most recent novel, The Keep, which is published by Knopf. Thank you, Jennifer, for joining me.
Thank you for inviting me.
You can read an excerpt from The Keep on the Bookworm page at kcrw.com. My associate producer is Melinda Siegel. The technical director is Mario Diaz, with production assistance from Alan Howard. I'm Michael Silverblatt. Join me again next time on Bookworm.
Books, books, books. Books can be funny, too. Books make you laugh and sing. Books tell you everything. They're your treasured friends in prose and rhyme. Now it's Book of the Mouse Club time. To the jungles you can go in books.
Funds for Bookworm are provided in part by Lannan Foundation. This program is produced in the studios of KCRW Santa Monica, and you can access archives of all Bookworm programs and podcasts, the most recent ones, from our website. Go to kcrw.com and look for Bookworm under KCRW A to Z. Plus, copies are available. For ordering information, call 310-450-5183.
They're your treasured friends in prose and rhyme. Now it's Book of the Mouse Club time.
I want to tell you about a new show from the Financial Times called Life and Art from FT Weekend, hosted by me, Lila Raptopoulos. Life and Art is twice a week. On Mondays, I have a guest on to talk about life and how to live a good one. Everything from winter travel to cooking to living more creatively. And on Fridays, we talk art. Two FT journalists and I discuss a piece of culture that's in the air. New music, movies, and more. Find Life and Art from FT Weekend wherever you listen.